Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
49 of the 50 states have some form of a balanced budget requirement that they advertise to their citizenry. And those balanced budget requirements, in theory, should keep spending in line with revenue and not allow the accumulation of debt over time. Unfortunately, the way the budget accounting works in a widespread way across the 50 states, some of the largest states are able to claim balanced budgets in part because, among other things, they compute the revenue, including anticipated borrowing proceeds, as a form of revenue, which is like talking to your spouse and saying, we're going to balance the budget this month. We're going to run up the credit card.
That's our guest, Bill Bergman of Truth in Accounting, talking about how state and city governments keep the hard realities of their financial status clouded by special terms and accounting notions that we couldn't get away with in our own homes. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, co-host with Ellen Brown of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, and today we're going to discuss a new annual report of the Financial State of the States, which grades and compares states and cities. And guess what? North Dakota ranks at the top, both in terms of financial stability and public support. If you're a public bank fan, I think you know why. These financial reports are the only window we have, really, into the labyrinthian network of accounts and funds that our governments manage on our behalf. We think you'll appreciate getting in touch with these reports so you can see for yourself where your state ranks and what the realities are. Meanwhile, globe-trotting Ellen is out at a conference discussing future dimensions of money, such as cryptocurrencies and blockchain.
All right, Ellen. Well, you're off to yet another conference back here in the States. And this one is really, really interesting, the Nexus Conference. It's a gathering of some of the top names in contemporary thinking on money and new technologies, blockchain, cryptocurrencies. This is going to be, it sounds like a really unique event with lots of headliners, very well-known headliners like Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and Peter Schiff and Max Keiser, which should be fun, David North, Edward Griffin, and Ellen Brown, among other stars. So I imagine you're looking forward to it since it's going to be in Aspen and you're a featured speaker.
Yes, well, I have to do a 50-minute presentation, but I'm also on three panels. So last week we talked about, largely about the Indian system, how they're using cryptocurrencies and are on the road to having a national mutual credit system where you basically are turning your own credit into money through your cell phone. So what I thought, since I was looking at these panels that I have to be on, one of them is on universal basic income, and I just saw an article in Zero Hedge where Mark Zuckerberg, of course, of Facebook fame, supports a universal basic income, I think because technology is taking all the jobs. And then there was the article was by Ms. Shedlock, who was saying that it was a stupid idea, that it can't work because you'll have to pay for it with taxes, and who's going to pay the taxes? Everybody's going to want to be getting the UBI instead of being the half that pays the taxes, which, to my mind, totally misconstrues the whole conception. You don't pay it with taxes. You just pay it. You pay it as a form of quantitative easing or qualitative easing. Everybody gets it. That's why it's called universal basic income. Everybody gets it, and then you don't have squabbles over it. You don't have cheating to try and show that you that you qualify, everybody qualifies. That makes it really easy across the board. And the idea is to get the demand out there that you need to run an economy when half the economy is unemployed. It's projected that in 45 years, machines and technology and computers and robots will be better than humans at everything, and that in the next 100 years, they'll have taken all the jobs. So clearly, unless you're going to let the people starve, you have to have a way to get money to the people. And also, machines don't shop. If you want to have demand for your products, you've got to have some human beings out there. So the point of a universal basic income is not so much, it's not welfare. It's to keep the economy going. You've got to have buyers. You've got to have consumers. And, of course, the people have to eat. So you give everybody a minimum, maybe $1,000 a month, you know, enough to survive without actually living luxuriously, because you do want people to contribute. And that money, the objection to just printing it and giving it to them is that it would be inflationary, but it actually wouldn't. If you tax it in the ordinary way, let's say you put a 10% tax on it, which is what we have for a sales tax right now in California, in a good year, money changes hands 10 times in a year. The velocity of M1, the cash in the system, is 10. So if it changes hands 10 times and it gets taxed 10 cents every time it trades, by the end of the year, the whole dollar is going to have gone back to the government. So they could spend that dollar all over again, and it will go back to the government over and over. Or there was a famous experiment in, I don't know how to pronounce it, Wurgel, Austria, in the 1930s, where money was just printed, and the economy was in a depression. So money was just printed and put out there, and you had to put a stamp on it. It was a stamp tax that you had to put the stamp on it that you had to pay a little money for every month. And so the money, in effect, decayed. So after a period of time, the money wasn't good anymore. And first of all, the fact that it was decaying made people spend it more rather than hoard it. But also it just naturally expired. So you could keep putting new money out there, which people then spend, which would stimulate the economy. Or there's that famous joke or example of the wealthy German that comes into town, wants a room at a hotel, but can't make up his mind. So the hotel keeper says, well, just leave a $100 deposit, and then he could come back later if he wanted to change his mind. So the wealthy man did, and the hotel keeper then ran out and paid one of his bills, maybe to his grocer, and then the grocer ran out and paid his bill to somebody else, and then each one paid their outstanding bill to somebody else, and in the end, the $100 came back to the hotel. Oh, I guess it was a prostitute who was using
yes,
the hotel.
Yes, I was going to say, that's what I had her do.
So the $100 came back to the hotel, and then the wealthy man came in and said, well, he changed his mind. He didn't think he would stay there, and he took his $100. So, in other words, no money. The system was not inflated with new money. It was circulated. It allowed trade to circulate, and that's what you need, credit. You need to get money out there, which will then return to the government, and that's how you avoid inflation. But you got to get it out there first so that it can trade, and then it comes back.
And that, of course, is the embodiment of the big distinction between money considering money to be a commodity and money as a utility, which is what you've been talking about. And I think you're anticipating you're going to get some pushback at the Nexus conference from some of these star personalities and economists who are propping up that money is a limited resource. Do you, in fact...
Right, isn't it? We have to maintain the debt ceiling and maintain austerity and pay our bills before we think about increasing this $20 trillion debt. I mean, I can see why that freaks people out, but... And we will be increasing the debt. Now they're talking about lifting the debt ceiling. But the debt is simply our money supply. It's simply yin and yang of money. It's the negative side so that we can have a positive side that we spend.
And of course, it is the device that is used to keep us in line and participating on the hamster wheel of cranking out really interest, which is inflationary, to go to private hands and go to the people who are the financialists who are now, 40% of our economy. I think that's a fair figure from what I've read.
Or as Catherine Austin Fitz says, we basically have two economies. You've got the speculative economy, which is sucking all the profits out, and then the productive economy, and the productive economy is trying to support them both, which obviously doesn't work. So you actually
Right.
could have interest and still have it be sustainable if the interest goes back to the community, which is what we're talking about with the public banking system, like the Bank of North Dakota. So,
Right.
or like the original Pennsylvania Land Bank, where the government printed the money as paper script. It was lent to the farmers. A little extra was, like, say you printed $105, you lend $100 at 5% interest. You spend the five on government services. So you've got $105 out there. It all comes back as principal and interest. You lend the $100 all over again, spend the five all over again. It all comes back as principal and interest. You can do that over and over and over, and it's sustainable, even though it does involve interest. But if you have loans at interest over 30 years that are you're paying as much in interest as you are in principal, and the interest goes into more speculative things, like maybe goes into more loans at more interest, or goes into any kind of money-making money scheme, which is not actually supporting productivity, or even something like housing, where you're just driving the price of houses up, but you're not creating more houses, then that is not sustainable. And you'll wind up with the boom and bust that we're so familiar with.
Yeah, it is because our money is issued at interest that we have this scenario, in part. It's a fabulous universal franchise, but if the Treasury were simply to issue money for a universal basic income, the processes that you've described would be free to take hold, and new outcomes would be possible to appear, so that people would having a basic income would be able to feed an economy and to make the transactions. There would be no interest added, and the stability of the currency's value would also be established, right? I mean, isn't that one of the reasons that the dollar's lost so much of its value, is because of this overage of interest being added?
Banks issue money, create money at interest, but that could be a sustainable system. That's what I'm saying, if it all goes back into the economy where it's available to pay off the loans, but it doesn't. It gets siphoned off into this other economy.
You're going to see a lot of people who have had a very strong, you know, and Edward Griffin, I don't know if you've met him before. He's the fellow who wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island, talking about the Federal Reserve. Many of these people have been following you and conversations with you on both sides. It seems to me it's going to be a pretty exciting sort of an exchange, and their focus is on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, right?
Yeah, I think you'd have to say that I followed Ed Griffith. not the reverse. He was there before I was.
But the conversation is really vibrant and spreading through all of these new channels. I wonder what Jesse Ventura, who's going to be there and talking with you, has to say about the impact here.
Yeah, and Ron Paul's going to be there, and Dennis Kucinich. So that'll be interesting. I assume Dennis Kucinich will be talking about basically the positive money approach, 100% reserves.
Yeah.
And Ron Paul will be the libertarian Austrian approach. I'll definitely be the only public banking person there.
Do you think so? I mean, don't you? I mean, how about, you know, Max Kaiser and Stacy is also going to be Stacy Herbert. Both
of
them.
Well, their big
there.
Thing is Bitcoin, and they're not on the same panels that I'm on. So.
Well, it's going to be an exciting time. I think we'll look forward to hearing your report when you get back on that. I hope you, you know, knock them alive about what money really is.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Ellen. We'll talk to you soon.
Well, someone ought to be keeping score. of the true accounting of our public dollars, that is. And fortunately for us, someone is. Today we're going to speak with the Director of Research at Truth in Accounting, a nonprofit public interest organization that has taken on the work of gathering the true numbers about how much money cities, counties, and states actually have and how much they actually owe. Sometimes there's a bit of a distance between what is reported and what is the fact. Well, Truth in Accounting produces an annual report of all 50 states and many cities about these figures, compares them to other states and cities, and compiles them for public review. Our guest is Bill Bergman, who's up early every morning gathering these data points from around the country and present them in the context of an understanding that this public accounting of public dollars is a special art, and sometimes an art of obfuscation.
Bill, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Walt. Thanks for the invitation.
Would you tell us a little bit about the TIA?
Sure. Truth in Accounting is a nonprofit organization started by Sheila Weinberg, a CPA, back in 2002. Sheila's original interests were in the area of federal government finances and her concern about the claims to a balanced budget and a surplus at a time when, in fact, the real national debt was increasing, not decreasing. And one thing led to another from there. A few of her friends tugged on her elbow and said, if you think the federal government needs to be looked at, I think you should also take a look at Illinois. and we did, along with all 50 states, and our flagship product is the annual report that you are talking about that we just produced. We've been producing that since 2009. It's a look at all 50 states individually and collectively and their finances. Sheila's concerns have been driven importantly by concern about the ability of states to claim balanced budgets at a time when the real deficit or surplus is being masked by the cost of retirement benefits. And in turn, we adjust the publicly reported data and have been adjusting the accounting data for our view of the real balance sheet for all 50 state governments and a growing host of local municipalities. And it's that overview that it's valuable for three reasons. It's the most timely information that's out there on a 50-state basis for comparing all 50 states. It's been developed on a continually consistent basis since 2009, which gives you a read on trends in a world where the accounting numbers have had a convulsion in the accounting changes, but we have a consistent basis since 2009. And finally, perhaps most importantly, is developed with a view to the overall financial condition, not dedicated to the interests of bondholders, which is what credit rating agencies provide, or pensioners all by themselves, two different special interest groups. Our concern is with the average citizen, the average Joe and Jane, and that's the perspective that we provide for the overall view of the state government finances.
And as you point out, there are multiple tricks, as it were, counting ledger domain, that provides a different view of the realities. What are some of the tricks that government accounting offices use to mask what you say are the real assets and liabilities?
Well, it's getting harder to do these tricks because the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, to its credit, has actually been moving things in the right direction in recent years, and the ability to mask debt off the balance sheet, which we've learned in the private sector, can be a disaster. Things like Enron and other implosions were rooted, importantly, in false accounting and off-balance sheet debt. But that's not the case anymore, really, in our state and local governments. The Governmental Accounting Standards Board has developed standards that are forcing them now to put those numbers on the balance sheet, leading to greater awareness of the cost of those benefits and, in turn, the importance of funding those costs in the budget process. But there are still some tricks of the trade that are still operating despite this move in the right direction. And they include the fact that 49 of the 50 states have some form of a balanced budget requirement that they advertise to their citizenry. And those balanced budget requirements, in theory, should keep spending in line with revenue and not allow the accumulation of debt over time and push off the cost of government services to the future and the young and the unborn citizens. Unfortunately, the way the budget accounting works in a widespread way across the 50 states. And by the way, not all 50 states. There are some very good actors out there too. But some of the largest states are able to claim balanced budgets in part because, among other things, they compute the revenue, including anticipated borrowing proceeds, as a form of revenue, which is like talking to your spouse and saying, we're going to balance the budget this month. We're going to run up the credit card. But we don't get told that they're running up the credit card. We get told that they're balancing the budget. And there's a wide variance across the 50 states of states that really walk the talk on balancing the budget versus the states that don't. And some of the states that don't say they do. And that's we try to track that type of behavior.
And so some of the wells of money that the governments use to boost these include pension funds, right?
Yes.
That reflects both ways. You know, that we're way over our heads in unfunded liability, but then also they'll steal or take from the pension funds for boosting their numbers that way.
Yeah? Well, they don't necessarily take funds directly, but they do take pension holidays, quote-unquote, to not fund the pension as a way of getting revenue in the door, which is a good way to buy short-term success at long-term disaster.
One of the things that that we've been doing in the public banking movement, if you will, is the bringing awareness to the comprehensive annual financial reports, the CAFRs. And you folks have been very active and really probably the most diligent in the country about really digging into what those numbers are. Tell us what those are and how they relate to the budget of a city or a state.
Well, the simple way to think about the difference between budgets and CAFRs, these comprehensive annual financial reports, called CAFRs informally, the CAFR are results in theory, and the budgets are prospective planning documents. And a simple way to distinguish them is that the budget are the words and the deeds. The words are the budget, and the deeds are the results. And we try to track the words as well as the deeds. And some states are better than others at living up to the words. The words are the deeds, and others are not.
So when you look at the CAFRs and you're looking at the assets of the state, you're including all of the assets that are in those, in the CAFRs, which would be comprised of what would be some of the things that would be in the CAFRs that wouldn't show up on, let's say, the budget balance?
Well, we do look at all the assets, but we don't include them in our analysis. Two different types of assets, very simply to think about, are assets available to pay bills, which include liquid assets, as well as things like land and plant and equipment and capital assets. Our analysis, getting to the bottom line taxpayer burden that we produce, does not include assets that are capital assets, nor do we include the debt related to capital assets, just to be consistent on the other side of the coin. Capital assets, one lesson from history is not to rely on, say, selling your land or selling your buildings and leasing them back. We don't view them as being available to pay bills. There's an argument maybe you could or should, and some people are arguing that capital assets are a source of wealth that we haven't really discovered yet in our state and local governments. We don't believe that's the case, and we can talk about that. So what we do include the assets available to pay bills as a form of liquid assets, and the part of that are the assets that are also included in these pension funds. The pension funds are comprised of for all of our concern, which is valid, about the unfunded liabilities. They're massive, and the hundreds of billions of dollars. In fact, really close to $1 trillion across the 50 states. It's important to remember that there's massive assets. They're massively underfunded, despite the fact that there are huge investment portfolios in these pension plans, which can be a source of strength for well-funded plans, but they can also be a honeypot for investment managers and others that feast off of the the assets.
Yeah, and the fees that are paid by the municipality or the state for management of the money for and funding and so forth, those fees associated with the financing, are you able to incorporate those and define those readily enough?
You can look at the pension plan, not the CAFRs necessarily, but the actual pension plan reports themselves, and there will be a section on the investment management fees. We haven't compiled that data yet, but that's on our agenda. We've compiled a lot of data, and looking into the fees is another thing down the road.
Yeah, that's something that we've been interested in when we look at what Wall Street costs America. Trying to assess the real costs that are that override and accompany the way we finance ourselves through borrowing money,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a very rich territory. I hope you guys will continue. We'd like to know how we can help.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those costs include the other costs are interest expense. You know,
right.
Thinking about, and in fact, interest expense in a period of rapid declines in interest rates in the last 10 years, we've had a historic drop in interest rates. But the deterioration in state government finances has been accompanied with rising interest expense in a period of declining interest rates, which helps to distinguish between what we provide and what the credit rating agencies provide. They provide ratings for state and local governments, as well as for a wide variety of financial instruments, but those ratings have a focus on the bondholder, and among other things, I was at a meeting just a week ago talking about what we tend, you know, the message was other things equal, we tend to like sovereign credits, like state and local governments, because they have taxing authority.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good, for, you know, the taxing authority and the ability to force people to give you money is definitely a strength if you're a bondholder. But whether or not that's a strength if you're an average citizen is another question.
I noticed in your report that you changed some of your standards or category assessment to include the tax incentive of financing. This is an interesting area of great public interest, is how much tax money is being lost because it's being given to corporations to develop property and business.
Yes, it is, and it's in theory it's given for a broader public benefit as well as for the benefit of the individual business. Whether or not that's the case is a matter of significant debate. We don't have a policy position on that, but one thing to note is that another valuable initiative at the Governmental Accounting Standards Board has been to begin requiring significantly greater disclosure of these incentives in the CAFRs, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, beginning next year, and that's gonna help open the window in that area.
I know one of your neighbors up there, Tom Tresser, who wrote the book Chicago's Not Broke, has been doing quite a bit of work around assessing what those taxes, those tips, as they call them. What kind of impact that's had on the state's wealth.
Yes, and it's good to see that kind of work. I'm not sure I agree that Chicago is not broke, however.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's interesting. We can look at numbers in so many different ways,
mm-hmm.
but the assets that are available to cities and counties and states for a variety of investments varies all across the board. But in the banking world, as we talk about public banks and states looking at starting to do their own financing, one of the places they look is the CAFRs to see, you know, what resources might be available to be redeployed in the form of a bank finance.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that in your financial state of the states that really one of the grade A states is North Dakota. One of your top five, what you call sunshine states,
mm-hmm.
where the average taxpayer surplus ranges from $2,600 in Nebraska to $38,000 per taxpayer in Alaska. About $24,000 in North Dakota come in kind of second. What does that figure amount to? What does that represent?
Well, that $24,000 is the taxpayer burden. We define it as the either the surplus or the burden in most state cases. North Dakota is not one of them. It does have a surplus. It does have more money available to pay bills than all of its debt. The unfunded pensions are still there in North Dakota, but they also have looking across the overall balance sheet, they have more money available. And in fact, they're in a positive position. And that $24,000 is the per taxpayer share of the surplus.
Right. And the worst is out here in New Jersey, which has mm-hmm. gone from $59,000 to $67,200 in the red. That is a chronic condition in that state, and interestingly, the potentially the new governor there is talking about creating a public bank in hopes of trying to retain some of the capital that they've got mm-hmm. for investment back into the state level. I want to mention to our listeners that if you'd like to see this chart, the Financial State of the States report for 2016 has just been issued by the Truth in Accounting organization, and you can simply go to truthinaccounting.org, and it'll be very evident there. And Bill produces a morning blog, a report on some of the news from around the country, which must get you up early.
It's a challenge, but it's been a great learning experience, selfishly for me, trying to scouring the world every morning and trying to find relevant news for state, local, and federal government finances, and the reporting of those finances, the integrity of the reporting process, and that's what we do every morning, is try to scour the world for interesting stories, letting us pulling back the window on looking into our government's finances.
It's quite a portrayal of our money now. The national debt is a little bit different than the mm-hmm. state debt, insofar as.
And one reason it's different is how much bigger it is. Given we look at New Jersey, we look at Illinois, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Kentucky. Those are our five most heavily indebted states, but. Your share and my share of the national debt is much higher than our own state debts.
Well, we've been talking about the national debt here in a couple of different ways. I would say our position would simply be that the national debt is essentially our money supply, and that the obligation, the $20 trillion that we've amassed, on which we're paying huge amounts of dollars in interest every year, is not really an issue insofar as a sovereign government has the ability to spend and create what it needs to operate its economy. What's your thought about that?
Well, the $20 trillion that's publicly reported is part of the national debt, but two things to respond to your question is that our belief is that the real national debt includes massively underfunded and unfunded positions in Social Security and Medicare, and those positions swamp the publicly reported debt. But it's not publicly reported. It's not on the balance sheet of the United States government. And do you know why? The government explains that these are not debts of the government because the government can change the law as a sovereign entity and take those benefits away at any point in time. So our Social Security statements that give us our estimated benefits are just estimated benefits. They're not accounts, and the government can change the law at any time. That's why they don't include it on the national balance sheet, the federal government's balance sheet, which is a bit at odds with the Social Security Administration's new website that shows you a young guy looking off into the horizon, and it tells people to rest assured that the new account system that we have here, this website, gives you control of your future. But that's not what we are told when they tell us that the government can change the law and take away the Social Security benefits. That's one concern we have with the federal government's financial reporting.
And the truth, looking at the top of the Truth in Accounting website, and published national debt is 20-plus trillion. The truth, you say, is 103 trillion, which is a frightening sort of a figure, especially since you break it down to that our share as individuals is $316,000.
On a per-person basis, on a per-taxpayer basis, it's even much larger. Yes, it's a large dollar figure. One thing that you'd mentioned, the sovereign authority of the government, why we should think about that. I agree that we should. And introducing the balance sheet, the federal government has a paragraph in there introducing a balance sheet where even the reported assets are swamped by the reported liabilities, which themselves are understated. But we get some comforting language in the paragraph introducing the balance sheet. And here are the sentences that are theoretically comforting. There are, however, other significant resources available to the government, capital G, government, beyond the assets presented in these balance sheets. They include the government's, possessive S, sovereign powers to tax and set monetary policy. And it, certainly the government has the power to tax, and some people argue that we should capitalize that power to tax and include that as an asset when looking at the federal government's balance sheet, but we don't agree with that assessment.
It seems that the world financial bubble that we live in is really one built around the debt structures that we're obliged to serve. And yet, we're never going to be paying off the national debt. I don't think it has been paid off since Andrew Jackson, from what I'm told, 1835 or something. And that we wouldn't want to do that because that would disappear, basically, the money in the economy. So that it seems like it's kind of an unnecessary pursuit that we would live within, or at least try to constrain our abilities to do things by someday having to pay off this $20 trillion, which, of course, is now almost going to be 22 by the end of this conversation.
Tick-tock, yeah. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Yeah. Now, I agree. I mean, I see that certainly the difference between the state and the government is not just a matter of scale. It's really a matter of household finance. And so what you guys are doing brilliantly, and I think it's just a great public service, is helping us to know what those figures are and then pull the covers back over off of the reality of the numbers that that we're living with, and also to discover the chicanery, if you will, that the management, government managers are managing to convince us of to justify their policies. Yeah.
Well, when you use the word chicanery, one thing that we see looking across the 50 states is that the states that have accumulated the highest taxpayer burden, a couple of years ago, Gallup did a poll of trust in state government, and you can see a pretty strong relationship. The states that walk the talk, that actually do live within their means, that actually do balance their budget, coincidentally or not, and I believe it's not, the states that are walking the talk tend to have higher trust in state government. States like New Jersey, Illinois, Connecticut, Massachusetts, yeah. Rhode Island, they fall down near the bottom on those trust in state government surveys, which in turn is also reflected lately, sadly, in out-migration. You see higher out-migration from states like New Jersey and Illinois and Connecticut, yeah. in ways that it's exacerbating their financial situation.
I mean, one of the states, I think they may have been the top, was once again North Dakota,
mm-hmm.
where their state finances have been strong for a long, long time. As you probably know, Bill, they're the only state that has a public bank, 98 years old, consistently produces year-on-year profits. But that stability that they have, because they're independent of the rest of the global financial cartel, gives them a much different stage from which to conduct their policies and practices.
Yes, and North Dakota has done well, that's for sure. It's also maybe important to recognize that you always have to ask the question, are you this good or are you this lucky? And the massive increase in oil prices in the last decade until the last few years is something that's lifted the boat at North Dakota as well. Looking down the road, there are some states that if they had, again, this is not our, we don't have a policy position on public banking, but public banking can be managed well or it can be managed poorly. And it thinking about the prospects for New Jersey or Illinois with a public bank, that gets a little scary in my head, given the
Yes, because it would be breaking with a pattern of basically corruption, collusion, and some mismanagement. And
so. Honest banking is very important, both in the private sector and in public banking. We have a Federal Reserve, for instance, that is our public bank. And
I don't know that that applies to the Federal Reserve. I mean, that they're hardly a public bank, even though they serve that public role.
Well, that's an interesting debate. If on the one hand, they're the Federal Reserve Bank. Shares are owned by banks, but it's a mixed breed.
Right.
And at the end of the day, the Congress created the Fed, and they could eliminate it tomorrow. And that's at the end of the day, the Federal Reserve is a government creature.
Uh-huh.
How good of a creature it is another debate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and by the way, I just wanted to go back over your point about petroleum revenues in North Dakota, just as an illustration of the security regarding what a public bank, what the public bank itself as an organizational systemic structure has provided those profits independent of the welling up of profitability around fossil fuel. I mean, they started with their year after year profits way back in, I guess it was the early part of the 2000s. It's been 12 or 13 years now they've had year after year growth, even though the oil market has boosted up and then crashed. And that stability, as I think we think, is a pretty interesting indicator of the independence and financial security that a public bank can provide to a state, independent of some of these, you know, variations that happen in the global and the regional economy. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that'd be interesting. You know, I'm curious now to look at North Dakota compared to, for instance, Wyoming or Oklahoma, where their net positions in the last year and a half or 2 years or so, you can see a hit that they've taken, and I'm now curious to go take a look at North Dakota more closely.
Yeah, and I think Alaska took a bit of a hit too.
Oh yes. The,
yeah.
Yeah, they're the most highly exposed on this score. And they built up a strong, you know, positive net position. Whether or not it's sufficient is another question.
Well, we're trying to get them to get a public bank too. So, this is exciting, Bill, to have a chance to connect with you. I really appreciate your sharing these thoughts and insights with us on the show. And I want to say once again, for those of you listening wanting to get more information about what Truth in Accounting is doing and to take a look at the Financial State of the States report for 2016, go to truthinaccounting.org. And it'll all be there. And by all means, sign up for Bill's blog on the website and avail yourself of that stuff as well. Bill, thank you once again.
Waldo, it's good to talk to you. Nice to meet you.
That's Bill Bergman, Director of Research at Truth in Accounting. That website address again is truthinaccounting.org. Now we head to Chicago, where the intrigue of insider corporate public finance has spawned a citizen movement called the TIF Illumination Project, as well as a collaborative book that's aiming to educate citizens about how to get a grip on the public dollars that are slipping away through rather secretive but commonplace methods used by municipalities around the country, ostensibly to stimulate local economies by giving tax breaks to special interests. Tax increment financing, or TIFs, as they're called. Our guest, Tom Tresser, is a longtime public banking supporter and leader, considers himself a civic educator and a public defender against the machinations of crony politics. The book is called Chicago is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve.
The TIF Illumination Project caught fire because of a couple of things lining up here in Chicago a few years ago. So Mayor Emanuel was elected. He's perceived as a privatizer, you know, sort of the new face of the Chicago machine, you know, Chicago machine 3.0, and then he's closed 50 schools. So nobody's ever done that, not even Daley, in the height of his power, did something like that. And, you know, the city was reeling. Many of us thought that was just even too much for him, and that anybody with a kid in school, it was just chaos. But as a result of that trauma going through the city, when we just started the launch of the TIF Illumination Project, it was in the middle of all that.
Describe for us what TIF is.
TIFs, tax increment financing, is something that is prevalent all over the country. It's another one of these snarky deals where a mayor essentially creates a special district ostensibly to build something that couldn't be built otherwise in a so-called blighted area. And what happens is when a TIF district is created, we note how much property tax the properties inside the TIF district are spinning off at that moment, which is called the base. And you need to remind ourselves about how many organizations in the country rely on property taxes to operate. In many states, property tax fuels public education. And in the state of Illinois, it's excessively so because we have a regressive income tax, one of the worst in America, which means there's an extra burden on property tax across the state to fund public education. So if you live in a wealthy community, property taxes are high, and there's a mall or a factory or other things spinning off lots of property taxes, then your schools will be flush and will want for little. But you go a few miles away and you're in a poor part of the county, and the opposite happens. Your schools look like crap. So then your education, access to great education, is a lottery based on where you were born. So that's not right. People have been writing about public education and equity and connections between a robust public education system and our democracy and middle class. All those things are tightly intertwined. Note with despair that this difference happens in places that rely unfairly on property taxes, which is the case in Chicago and Illinois. And that's why we need to note any entity that takes a dollar of property tax off the table. That's what TIFs do. So in the TIF district, once it's created, the TIF now siphons, extracts all property tax value above that base for 23 years.
Wow.
So
23 years?
Yes, it's a generation. And it started in California and it moved all over the country. It's in 47 states right now. There is no single accounting, actually. This is something we're actually trying to address here with the newspaper magazine In These Times. And we're going to be launching a national research project to try to just count how many TIF districts there are in the country and just how much are we talking about. My estimation is that there could be as many as 6,000 of these TIF districts, which are all controlled by local mayors, that are pulling away maybe as much as $20 billion in property taxes every year. So what happens to these taxes once they're extracted? You know, they're off the top. They go into essentially a black box controlled by your local mayors to be dispensed in a giant slush fund for projects that are favored by the mayor. And in Chicago, $7 billion in property taxes have gone missing since TIFs came here in 1986. We're not sure where a lot of that money went, but our best guess is approximately $5 billion of that $7 billion went to developers.
And why is it not transparent? Why can't you track it, Tom?
Because you don't want us to. This is the goose that lays the golden egg. This is the secret sauce behind the Chicago machine, where, you know, Mayor Daley took power in, 1989, and he ruled for almost 27 years, I think. And TIFs under his administration skyrocketed from, you know, relatively handful to, I think there's 164 TIF districts. And then when Mayor Emanuel came in, he closed some and started a few more. So right now there's about 148 active TIF districts. But they throw off $500 million in property taxes every year. That's a pile of money that no mayor wants to do without. And like I say, in just about every state, virtually every cities everywhere are struggling with this. So the mayors want them, and taxpayers and other kinds of researchers or other kinds of advocates are pushing back against them. School districts are suing their own mayors.
Yeah.
Because the schools are the biggest single loser when a TIF is created.
I noticed one of your figures in Chicago's Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, which is the name of the book, that you point out that about $500 million was cut from the school budget, and then that the mayor wants to still raise $1 billion to fund expansion of a civic center. Is that right?
Yeah. So the book, Chicago's Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, is based on the TIF work. Because if you're showering hundreds of millions of dollars on private businesses without much due process, then we really can't be broke. But then, as I say, Chicago has closed public schools, mental health centers, curtailed public transit. So everyone's feeling the squeeze all over the city. At the same time, property taxes are going up. Regressive methods of getting money, like red light cameras that zap you with a $100 fine, and speed cameras and fees and fees and more fees. All these things are being heaped on the people. And so we're trying to push back against that entire narrative of scarcity. And this is what we have in common, you know, as civic educators, is we're trying to tell the public that do not accept the frame of America is broke, Illinois is broke, or Chicago is broke until we have thoroughly investigated these other aspects of public finance. So
right. What
we're doing is we're looking at three pockets of money. The first pocket of money is called money that's been stolen from us, money that we should not have had to spend nor should continue to spend. And that's corruption, bad toxic bank deals, which is what you guys are researching on a national level. But we have some really doozies of crappy deals here in Chicago. Toxic swaps with the Board of Education is probably at the top of that list. And then also the cost of police violence. Unfortunately, across America, you know, a spotlight has been thrown on shootings of unarmed black men by various police forces. And in Chicago, we have a horrible, horrible record of abuse of civilians by the police force over decades, including torture and unarmed shootings. And just in the last 10 years, the police department and the city of Chicago settled lawsuits and litigation to the tune of $600 million.
Wow.
So these abuses continue, and they don't get checked. They don't get reined in. They just get passed along, and the police department doesn't reform itself.
Mm-hmm.
Cover-ups continue. Mm-hmm. And so we have a Polk Award-winning journalist, Jamie Calvin, who broke the story on the shooting of Laquan McDonald back in October of last year. And it was his article in Slate called 16 Shots that ripped the cover off this entire brutal piece of Chicago's history. So that's a very sad part of this book. So we've wasted that money. The lives are lost. The lives are beyond repair. But what we're saying is stop that practice. But if we don't stop the practice, we're going to lose another $5 to $10 million a year, not to mention whatever lives are ruined.
Yeah, and you've estimated that that bucket one or that parcel of money that you didn't need to spend amounts to $1 billion.
About,
new,
yes.
Or
yeah,
released
right.
Revenue every year.
That's right.
That's right,
because we're talking about cost of corruption itself. The team of academics and researchers have been working on this for decades. They say it's about $500 million a year. So if we don't correct the endemic corruption, that's a $500 million we're wasting right there. The cost of the toxic bank deals are estimated to have been about $1 billion up to now, but it will be another billion going forward if we don't correct or back out of those deals. And then the cost of police violence is another $5 to $10 million a year. So that's bucket one. Bucket two is the TIFs. So we've already talked about TIFs. The way I'm characterizing it for the sake of this book is, well, we are collecting this money. This property tax is being collected as part of our regular annual tax cycle, but it's hidden from us. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's off the books.
Money, you say, is hidden. It's taken off the tax, but isn't it authorized on some level by the city council? Or
yes, yes. Every TIF district is passed by law. You know, there's a statute that creates every TIF district, but it's a completely opaque process to the taxpayer. It's not part of the annual budgeting process, which is already sketchy and full of rubber stamp accords to the mayor's wishes. But the property taxes that are on the books, which is about $850 million and change, that will show up and is part of the annual budget cycle that does get some debate, at least in city council. So what we're saying is the budget is a moral document, aside from a political document, and this is how we know where our world is going, where our city is going, where our priorities are, what's being attended to and what's not being attended to, regardless of the lip service that's being paid to various topics. We always say follow the money. You do the best you can as the budget is being publicized, and it's always a hurry up, again, rubber stamp process in the city of Chicago. But there is some opportunity, limited though it may be, for the public to have input on our budget. It happens very fast. But what we're talking about with TIFs is completely not that. It is not part of the budgeting process. It's a completely clout-driven, rifle-shot, project-by-project, you read about it in the funny papers process.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, it's about $500 million in property taxes taken off the table every year. The other part of this TIF conundrum is the amount of money that's in the TIF accounts, the sort of running balance, if you will. So in addition to how much money we're collecting, we also have a bunch in the bank. So money comes in, money is spent out of TIF districts, but we are still left at the end of the year with about a $1.5 billion balance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a separate issue that has now become quite controversial here in the city of Chicago. You've got the unions, you've got parents groups, good government groups sort of asking for an accounting of where the $1.4 billion is just sitting in the TIF accounts.
Yeah.
What is the disposition of that money? And so that's kind of part of this entire We just simply don't believe you, Mayor Mayo. So that's part of the second bucket. And the third bucket is where we really cross paths, because we call that bucket the money that we're not collecting. And that's three chapters there. The first is what would happen if we had a progressive income tax in the state of Illinois. Chicago's share would be very considerable. Second is a financial transaction tax on our Wall Street, you know, LaSalle Street, which is probably the single biggest component of the entire book. And then finally, last but not least, is what would happen if we had a public bank for the city of Chicago. And that's written by Amara Enya,
true,
who ran for mayor last year.
Yep. One of our colleagues.
Yes.
Yep.
And she breaks it out and explains it and, you know, introduces the concept for people who presume probably most people have not heard of this idea of a public bank. And, you know, she finally says, okay, so what would it look like here? Well, you know, what would we do with such a thing here in Chicago? How would it help us? She chose to focus on the amount that we could save here if we self-financed our bonds
right.
and other kinds of infrastructure. And it's billions of dollars that we would save.
Yeah, billions of dollars, yeah.
And so that's pretty, you know, you put it all together, and it's a big number.
Well, you know, it's really necessary because of the obfuscation that's done around municipal finance, the control, the acquisition, you know, and how it's deployed, the fees that are paid to people who are financial mm-hmm. managers in the Wall Streets, and, of course, these rotten swap deals that has consumed hundreds of billions of dollars really around the country, it's stunning. And that's what Wall Street Cross America Project is doing. Mm-hmm. It truly is a national issue that is so below the surface, below the radar of people's awareness, that when they complain about taxes, they have no idea where this money is really going to, nor do they have a sense of what it would look like if they were to do, as you said, taking back control of it. Yeah, so your work's very exciting and great example of what citizens can do in their own municipalities. And, you know, we certainly look forward to partnering with you in helping to articulate some of these opportunities.
We will have teaching guides. People can do study groups. They can use this material in their churches, in their block clubs, in their elementary schools or high schools. We'll make a comic book version of this thing. And the idea is to flood the civic market with this information for the next 6 months in order to influence the debate over the 2017 Chicago budget.
Yeah.
So we want people to be waving these little books, you know, at their aldermen.
Great. It's interesting that in this day where we have the internet and the ability and social media and the ability to really talk to each other, parties are being sidestepped by the people. And of course, we see that in some ridiculous examples on the national stage and some encouraging ones where the mainstream parties are not able to necessarily keep their people in control.
Well, it's funny you mention that because this is actually part of a 3-year arc that leads to Chicago's 2019 municipal elections. You know, we're trying to think ahead, and you know, you make the citizens armed and dangerous, and then you start doing a candidate training school in 2018 to encourage people from our world, the people that we know, who we met all across the city, and other organizers and progressive forces, to try to get people to run for office, you know, as candidates for aldermen in 2019, using this book as partly of their platform. In my fantasy world, candidates who are seeking to run for alderman and even mayor in 2019 would have to speak to these issues, or they'll be defeated.
And we actually are seeing candidacies around the country who are people who are building their platforms around public banking.
Exactly. The more they talk about it, the more sense it makes. Yep. Now that makes them a leader in their community. It makes them an innovator. They're bringing something new, a solution to the table. And then now they take on that role of being a civic educator. Because to be a good leader, especially when you're edging out, like we are here with this idea of a public bank, you have to educate. And so you're educating, you're making people angry, you're revealing the conflicts and contradictions of the current system, you're calling out people for liars, profit takers. But at the end of the day, the best leaders will have a solution. And they say, you know what? We have a solution for you. And don't take my word for it. Just look at the great state of North Dakota.
Right.
A conservative, prairie, Republican state. If they can do it, why can't we? And then your citizens are left with like a good question. Like, you know, that's a darn good question. Why can't we? You know, that's where the revolution happens, right in there. When you have a lot of people scratching their heads going, that looks like a darn good idea to me.
Thanks very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
That's Tom Tresser. The book is Chicago Is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve.org. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.